Between here.
Well, interesting.
This is messed up.
You slept during the day?
I had enough. From 4 to 6 or something.
I went through and picked them up, but it's still so infused with it.
I use all the mushrooms.
No, this evening it doesn't bother me as much. Like, but I had like a piece of candy this morning in the afternoon. Is it like sugar free?
Sometimes
I think they're called Taliols. The two things I figured out first were peppers, like red and green peppers, and baked sweet potatoes.
I can't think of anything,
but sometimes I have to put it in.
Okay, everybody, I guess this is it for today. People are still away or whatever. Okay, anyway, hope all of you had a wonderful Yom Tov, and stay safe. Yerushalayim is...
Would you recommend going to the hotel these days?
I would not recommend going to the hotel these days, no.
Not during the day, not at night, nothing?
No. Unless you're with a large group. Certainly a woman alone should not go to the hotel. No. And, you know, I understand the Kotel is a holy place, but the halacha is that you don't put yourself in dangerous situations. That is the halacha. And you're not allowed to rely on the divine miracles that can save you because it's a dangerous situation. So, just like Maris HaMachpelah is a very, very holy place, but we would not recommend that you go there. So one, you need to be very, very careful.
That's well, the incidents that are happening, they're happening at the domestic gate, not... anywhere near the
Kotel. Well, you know, you got to go. I understand that, but you know, you don't take a helicopter and get dropped down by the Kotel. How do you get
no,
to the Kotel?
No, you go through the Milam Wall, which has nothing to do with the Master Gate.
Well, that means you go through Yaffa Gate, Shar Yaffa. In other words, there are gates. You have to go through the old city to get to the Kotel, unless you go all the way around, which is still through an Arab neighborhood. Meaning you cannot.
No, you know where that's David Tower? Is that what it is?
That's Yaffa Gate. Gate. Yeah, with Yaffa
that's
Gate, you still walk
it's
through.
Not safe?
It's not. You're still walking through an Arab market. It's not the safest thing to do.
I know, but you go through the Jewish quarter. Obviously, you want to walk through the.
Yeah, unless it's
day. Yeah, but to get to the Jew, once again, okay, you know, again, I mean, you can make your own judgments. I'm not telling you it's Usher, but one has to think twice about it. And you may people do live. Yeah, first people live there. Are you allowed to live there? Well, you don't have to move. You're there. But you might think about getting pepper spray also. That might work.
No?
Yeah, either one. I see them selling pepper spray, but I guess you can get mace too. Mace is better? Yeah, Israel, they do pepper spray. Yeah, which you're allowed to use on Shabbos even, so don't worry about it. And like, Well, if there's an error, if there's an error, if you can carry, carry
like,
views in the front.
Allocate this.
Okay, but be it as it may, you know, we know that in the long run, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is certainly going to protect the Jewish people, protect Am Yisrael, protect Eretz Yisrael, protect Yerushalayim. And Mashiach is coming for sure. But as an individual, you know, there are going to be, you know, there can be korbanos, and there are korbanos, there are sacrifices. So the overall divine protection for the Jewish people still doesn't mean that every individual is going to be safe from things happening. So you do have to be very, very careful. Does the school have a policy? The school leaves it to everybody to make your own decision.
Policy, but what?
About going to the Kotel, going to the Old City.
Yeah, you go in pairs.
Yeah, yeah, you just go in pairs.
Go in twos.
Okay, okay.
You're always going in pairs?
Most schools are banned from the public areas, right?
Yeah. In fact, one of the guys in my other school, Nor Sameach, told me he went to the Kotel Shabbos afternoon, and he said there was like nobody there, and he's walking, and it's just he just sees one Arab. He was really frightened. The Arab didn't do anything, but just him and one Arab, but like the whole.
No one around.
Yeah, so he made a vow. If Hashem saves him, he'll give $100. And he was asking me about that. He
didn't. Pepper spray.
He didn't remember if he said $100 or $100. So according to halacha, if you made a vow and you don't know which higher amount or lower amount, you got to give the higher amount. So so he does have to give $100 for that. But okay. Anyway, we last time we were digressing into other things. But if you remember, the main topic we're talking about at this point. This whole thing is we're doing medical ethics, but we obviously branch out and digress. And we had done organ donation. I think we had completed that. We had finished organ donation. That was
really?
I think so. Yeah, I think we spent 3 or 4 weeks on it. So we did a lot. So we started now. I believe fertility technologies generating new life. We know that fertility, of course, is a very, very big area of medicine, even in the secular world. People want to have children, and in the religious world, even more so. Remember that the first mitzvah of the Torah, of the 613, is in last week's parsha, be fruitful and multiply. This is pru urvu. It's a mitzvah to have children. Now, there's an interesting little complication here. The Gemara says something which at first glance may not make sense to you. The mitzvah to have children is a mitzvah on the man. It is not a mitzvah on the woman. Now, obviously a man cannot have children without a woman, so there's a mitzvah on a man to find a wife who wants to have children. But technically, the woman has no obligation to have children. The obligation is on the man. And how the Gemara derives this is an interesting way, because when the Torah says, be fruitful and multiply, it says right afterwards, pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply, umilu es haaretz, fill the earth. And then it uses an interesting verb, vikivshuha. Kivshuha means to conquer, dominate. And the Talmud says, conquest is a male activity. It is not a female activity. That is why women do not fight in an army. In other words, the halacha, at least halachically, in Israel, they draft them sometimes. But halachically, a woman is not supposed to be in the army, because combat and conquest are male. And since having children is described as conquest, indeed if you're a parent sometimes it feels like you're waging a war, so women are technically exempt. Now the question would be, though, that's how we know it. But what's the logic? Why would a woman be exempt? Why would the mitzvah... Remember, the woman has all the suffering. The woman has the suffering, but the man has the mitzvah. Yeah.
So what about women that were involved in war? Because women would go to war, they would dress more alluringly, that they would have a more chance of actually surviving.
Yes, now are you referring to...
After war. So
yeah.
Isn't that being involved in a war?
Well, generally speaking, in an ideal Jewish world, and you know, the world is not ideal, women are not supposed to be involved in military activity. Now, the truth of the matter is, even in the Tanakh itself, there are some cases of women being involved in war. The outstanding example, and she was a righteous prophetess, is Devorah. Right? Devorah was a judge, and she was also the military leader. And if you remember, in Devorah's war, the woman who finished off the general, the Russia, Sisera, was Yael, And Yael actually did what you're describing. She enticed him into something that looked like it would be a sexual liaison. She got him drunk, although it's on fermented milk, interestingly enough. So apparently that can get you drunk. And she drove a tent stake through his temples. So you are correct. There are unusual cases, and you know. All I can say is that in the halachic system, they were never taken as the norm, meaning they were exceptional cases, and we normally don't advocate that. In fact, not only that, according to Chazal, not only did Yael tempt Sisera, Yael actually had relations with him, and that's a very unusual situation. This is a rare category that Chazal described as Aveira Lishma. This is a very, very difficult category. Avera Lishma means a great, great sin that is totally for the sake of heaven. And sake of heaven, sake of God, meaning she did a great sin. She's fornicating with a Gentile. But
the power of Queen Esther, not the same situation.
It's a similar situation. But there is one big difference, and that is Esther was forcibly taken, as opposed to Yael, who initiated the content, right? So you're correct. Esther is another example, but Esther was more of a duress or coercion. Yael initiated, and this is a rare category which none of you should apply in your own life, called an Aveira Lishma, a sin that is done totally for the sake of heaven, 100%, and God in some ways can even count that as a mitzvah in exceptional circumstances. A sin for the sake of God. That's the phrase. Heaven is... Well, it's an act. It's an action that is normally a sin. In other words, she's sleeping with a non-Jew.
Wasn't Yael not Jewish,
though? Well, according to Chazal, Yael was Jewish, actually. Yael was Jewish. She was married to the descendants of Yisro, who converted. It does say she was married to the descendants of Chever. Chever is one of Yisro's names, and... Chazal says she was Jewish in that way. That is why Yael, as you know, Yael is a Jewish name, right? Women are, because she's considered to be a righteous woman. If she wouldn't be righteous, we would not use her name. Yeah.
I heard also Zimri is with
Cosby. Yeah.
Lishma.
Yeah. There are some midrashim that say that. Of course, keep in mind that Zimri and Cosby were killed, right? So in a sense, it's a little harder to say that they did a righteous act.
They have righteous intentions?
Yeah, so here you have to understand something. There are two different concepts here. Sometimes we say somebody really did sin, but their motives were good. Mm. But then we get to another level where the motives are so purified that the sin is not even a sin. That's a higher, unusual level. As opposed to you did a sin. For example, even the guy who gathered wood on Shabbos, who got killed, his kavana was for God, because after the spies, and they were told they weren't going to Israel, so many Jews felt we don't have to keep Shabbos anymore because we're not going to be going to Eretz Israel. So he deliberately desecrated Shabbos to get himself killed so that people would know you have to keep Shabbos. So these are complicated ideas, but just be aware of it. Okay, but be it as it may, since going back to procreation, since childbearing is called conquest, women are exempt, but the man has a mitzvah to find a wife that is able to have children and wants to have children. Now, why would a woman be exempt? Why would the mitzvah be on the man? Yeah, right. So one of the explanations that's actually given is that pregnancy and childbirth are dangerous. And the Torah, in fact, to this very day, even in this very day, women dying in childbirth is not as uncommon as you might think, not only in third world countries, but even in industrialized countries, women do die. That is why when a woman goes into labor on Shabbos, we drive the women, or we call the ambulance, or whatever needs to be done, because it is considered to be a matter of life and death, as it is. So the Torah is not going to obligate a woman to put her life in danger, but the Torah tells a man, you have to find a woman who wants to do this, and that way you fulfill your mitzvah.
Like a woman prevents herself from having a child. That's kind of...
So here we have to differentiate. A woman per se does not have a mitzvah to have a child, but a woman or a man are not allowed to sterilize. So for example, unless there is cancer or something like that, a woman cannot have either tie her tubes or a hysterectomy. Now obviously if there's cancer, that's a life-threatening situation, so you can do everything that needs to be done. In fact, that's a whole issue though about, what do they call it, the prophylactic ovarian removal, that there are women now who have either hysterectomies or a total removing everything, not because they have cancer, but because based on family history, they anticipate getting cancer of the ovaries, 10, 20 years down the line. They want to do prophylactic removal. That is a very, very serious halachic question. But putting the cancer issue aside, if cancer is not an issue, tubal ligation is prohibited, removal of ovaries is prohibited, hysterectomies are prohibited. For a man, vasectomies are prohibited, meaning to say, even if a woman doesn't have a mitzvah to have children, you're not allowed to mutilate the reproductive organs. Not only that, not only for men and women, you can't even remove the reproductive organs of animals. Big, big problem. If you have a dog or a cat, I hate to make life more complicated for you, but if you have a dog or a cat, and every veterinarian in the world and every humane society advises you to spay them, neuter them, and the like, halachically, there's a very, very serious shaila. And what you need to do, there are more details about this, it's like selling your chametz. You need to kind of sell your dog to a non-Jew, and the non-Jew should bring it to a non-Jewish veterinarian who can do the operation, and then you buy your dog back. You cannot have your dog or your cat castrated or neutered in that way.
Can a Jewish person do it from someone not Jewish?
No. A Jewish person cannot do it, which is a very big problem. I'll tell you where it's a big problem. If any of you want to be a veterinarian, so unless you work for the zoo and you're working with lions and tigers, the average veterinarian makes their living by neutering dogs and cats. So if you're a Jewish veterinarian, then every single day you're doing countless sins. So the way people get around it, if you're religious, and there aren't that many religious veterinarians, although there are some, I know some, is that they don't do the final cut, meaning to say they prepare, they prep, they put the dog under anesthesia, whatever they do for a dog, and the final cutting is done by a nurse or by an assistant, etc. So technically, the act of castration is not done by the Jewish person. That's something to be aware of. Also, let me point out, for those of you that are interested in veterinary medicine, that the prohibition of castration is only anatomical, physically removing the organ. If you have chemical castration through drugs, which cause a lack of blood flow and the like, that is permitted, and therefore, scientifically, veterinary medicine is developing certain methods of castration by injection and
why
the like.
Why is that allowed?
Because the particulars of the Torah's prohibition refers to physically mutilating the reproductive organs.
For a human also?
Say again?
For a human also?
Well, for a human, theoretically it might be allowed, except for the fact that there's a mitzvah on the man to have children, so you wouldn't be allowed to do it for
what
that reason.
Had children?
Okay, I'll discuss how many, when you've done, I'm sorry, yeah. Okay.
So what's if you already have a boy and a girl?
Yeah, I'll get to how many, yeah. Now let me just mention that regarding this idea of women being exempt, there's another reason that is given, which is almost the opposite, and that is women don't need a commandment to have kids, mm-hmm. because there is more of a natural maternal instinct, especially when coupled with a biological clock, meaning to say a man needs a mitzvah because otherwise a man could have the attitude, oh, I'll wait another 10 years to have kids, I'll sow my wild oats before I settle down. So the mitzvah pushes the man to kind of try to get married and have a family. Women have a sense of what you might call more of a natural urgency and desire, and therefore they don't need a mitzvah. This is a thought that you see in a number of places. God gives commandments to those who otherwise wouldn't behave this way. Those who would behave that way anyway don't need a commandment. I'll give you an example to this. one of the controversies in the Orthodox feminist community is about women and minyan. And without getting over, in fact, even here in Katsuma, these are some issues that that are going on, although I'm sure you never go near those places. And people ask the question, well, why, you know, if Judaism says men and women are, you know, equal in dignity and equally beloved by God, and even women have some spiritual advantages over men, etc. So why should it be that you can't count a woman in a minyan? Like, why can't a woman be counted in a minyan? And if you're going to say, well, we don't want mixed minyans because it's not modest, all right, so let there be an all-women's minyan. Why can't that do the same thing as an all-man's minyan? So one answer is, you know why we have to have a minyan? We have to have a minyan. We have to have 10 people doing righteous things to rectify the sin of the spies when you had 10 people doing bad things as a group of 10 bad spies. Women were not involved in the sin of the spies. Women did not commit the sins which necessitate rectification. If minyan is rectification for particular sins, those who were not guilty of the sin don't need to rectify anything, and therefore they don't constitute a minyan. The minyan was given, in fact, if anything, the minyan is like remedial math, right? If you flunk math, so you have to take math in the summer. If you got an A, now, if you're going to complain and say, you got an A in math, and you're going to complain, hey, why can't I go? Well, who would complain? But why can't I go to summer school math? I want to take a math course in the summer. We'll say, well, you didn't flunk, so you don't need the remedial math. Minyan is a remedial procedure for those who messed up spiritually in the sin of the spies. Women did not do so.
Is that when the minyan started, like after the sin of
the spies? That's correct. Because the whole source of why a minyan is 10 is because that's called Eda, congregation, and the spies are called Eda Ra'ah, an evil congregation. And therefore you need a good congregation, so to speak, to
like
rectify.
For a woman, it's like better for her to daven than there's a man.
Well, because once there is a minyan, we say God's presence does join, because God accepts, as it were, the repentance of the group that's coming together. So a woman should be part of that. She should join the group, but she does not become part of the minyan, because the minyan is for people who sin, or, you know, the neshamas that sins, that need rectification.
So it's kind of like they're doing tshuva, but they're reaching a higher level than we could.
Right. In a sense, at least in that context, because once again, the bal tshuva reaches certain levels in the course of that tshuva. But there's another aspect to minyan too. I just want to mention, and that is, you know, there's a truism. I'm sure you've heard this many, many times. It's really a cliche that one of the main differences between men and women is that women are willing to ask directions when they're lost, and men do not like to ask directions. That is why the GPS was invented by a man, for sure, because a man hates so much to ask directions. We have to invent something that says we don't have to ask. We'll just plug it into the GPS and the like. Now, that may sound superficial, but there's actually a very, very deep reason, Kabbalistically, why men don't want to ask directions. The initial creation, at least according to one view in the Gemara, is first there was Adam, and then Hashem made Chava from Adam. So the male's first moments in the universe were aloneness and isolation. And therefore his essential identity in some ways is predicated on autonomy, aloneness, not needing other people. And although he's supposed to overcome that, because it is not good for man to be alone, as it were, but there is this natural impulse in the male aspect of a person seeks, I don't mean isolation so much, but I mean control, not needing other people, self-sufficiency. Because Adam lived for a few moments without Chava. But Chava came into the world in the context of relationship. So for a woman, again, I'm generalizing, but these are tendencies. They don't apply 100% to every person. For a woman, reaching out and connecting is not foreign to her nature, because intrinsic to her nature is the notion of connecting. That is part of her existence. Her essential existence was imprinted with relationship, as opposed to man, his essential existence was imprinted with a sense of isolation. Now, therefore, the commentaries say the following. What is the idea of a minyan? A minyan conveys a very powerful message to a man that no matter how great you might think you are, there are some things you can't do unless you connect to other people. You could be the biggest tzaddik in the world, you could be the greatest rabbi of the world, you want to read the Torah, you want to say Kaddish, you want to say Kedusha, can't do it. You need to connect, you need to establish a relationship with other people. So once again, going with the idea that commandments are given to those who need rectification, one can look at minyan as a rectification to overcome the arrogance of autonomy by requiring the male to connect and establish relationships to the woman. That is a more instinctual activity, and therefore there's less of an obligation to pursue it. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is this is an aspect of procreation as well. That is, the maternal instinct negates the need for a commandment, because most women would feel a greater urgency in having children more than a man, because number one, a man is perhaps emotionally less detached, and number two, the man does not have a biological imperative to the same degree. Okay, but be it as it may, the bottom line is, halachically, that women are technically exempt, but a man is halachically obligated to find a woman from whom he could have children, and who desires to have children. Now, this does create some complications. Let's say, for example, no, you have to have a reality check here. Let's say, for example, you have a bachelor who is in his 40s or 50s, and he's not yet married. And he gets a marriage proposal, or shiduchim, for women who are already past menopause, who cannot have children anymore. So the guy is a frum guy, and the guy says, well, I'm sorry, I can only go out with women of who are capable of having children. Well, if he's 25 or 30, that's actually a correct argument. He should actually decline going out with people who can't have children, unless he already has children. I'll discuss that. But if he's 50 or 60, and there aren't going to be that many 20 or 25 year olds who are going to be interested, then he has to have a reality check at some point, and that is, hey, if you don't get married at all, you're certainly not going to have children. So better to be married than not to be married. So that's a delicate issue. I'm aware of like very religious older bachelors who refuse to go out with women who are above the age of 40 because they say got a mitzvah of having children, but at some point they have to be real. I mean, they have to assess the possibilities and the like. Now, how many kids do you need for the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply? So we have a minimum, right?
Right. Spreading to that.
Now, our minimum is two kids, and not only two kids, but one boy, one girl. So if you have five boys, not good enough, got to keep on going. If you have five girls, not good enough, got to keep on going. You got to have at least a boy and a girl. And then once you have a boy and a girl, the mitzvah of pru or vu has been fulfilled. Now, let's stop there. So, yeah, sure.
So what happens, there's a family that I know, and they're really trying to have a boy, and they had a 10th girl. Can they stop?
No.
Well, they have to keep going.
Well, again.
No, I mean, I don't know if they want.
Like anything else. If there are health issues or the like, you know, so one could be exempt from the mitzvah, you know, just as any type
tired.
Of. Well, that may be a factor. It depends. You know, what did I see about in China? Imagine this. You know, China.
You can choose changing.
Well, that is possible. You actually are. If they could change the sex or the like, I'm sure they can actually not do that yet. They can identify. Then you'd be permitted to change it, assuming there would be no health risks to the child. You know, China has this infamous, because of their population, mm-hmm. they have this infamous one-child policy. Did they change it recently?
Yeah,
okay. Now it's so, Baruch Hashem. But for many years they had a one-child policy, and this was very severely enforced. And as a result, especially in the countryside, people didn't want girls. They only wanted boys.
Yeah.
So it was very, very common for girls to be either killed or just abandoned, newborn baby girls to be abandoned. And I just read a story, this was a horrendous story, in which a woman in China, she claimed it was without fertility drugs, she gave birth to septuplets, seven.
Oh my God.
And it was two girls, and five boys. And the court, the whatever it is, the government ordered her, you have 1 week to decide which one you want to live. And then it said, this I can't believe this, and the rest will be thrown over a mountain. That's hard to believe. I don't know why they would do it that way. And both parents said, they were interviewed separately, and they said, well, for sure, we don't want the two girls, but we just have to choose between the five boys. Awful, awful, awful. You know, for sure, it's awful in so many different levels.
But could they consider it as one child? That was one birth. No, happiness. One birth.
Yeah, well,
and the kid got split.
Okay, listen. They should hire you for their lawyer and see. Maybe you'd win. But but it was a difficult situation. But now, Baruch Hashem, I'm glad they went up to two. But okay, beat is a bit. Now, what? Okay. Now, what happens after you have one and two? You have a boy and a girl. Are you supposed to stop? I mean, after all, why do religious families often have much more than that? So here, let me point out that there are two levels of obligation here. The mitzvah of pru urvu, which is one of the 613 commandments of the Torah, that is fulfilled when you have a boy and a girl. That's very, very true. And as far as that mitzvah is concerned, you could go on contraception once you've done that. However, there is what you might call a secondary mitzvah, which is not in the Torah, but it's in the prophets. It is the Navi Yeshayo, the Navi Isaiah, and he talks about why Hashem made the world. And he expresses what you might call a philosophical value of Judaism. So it's not a commandment, it is a value, it is an ethic of Judaism. And the ethic of Judaism says, Lo tohu bira'ah, Hashem did not create the world to be empty. La sheves yitzara. He created it to be inhabited by people. And therefore Chazal, as part of the oral law, understand this pasuk in Yeshayo as expressing an ethical value. That even if God does not command that you have more than a son and a daughter, ethically one should strive for as large a family as possible. Now let me explain why this is important. It's very important though to understand there's a difference between the obligation and the ethical value. So halachically, contraception, if there are factors that would justify it, like illness or stress or the like, is much more acceptable after you've done the basic Torah commandment. In other words, when you're just dealing with lasheves, this is called Lasheves, that's how we refer to the Pasuk, there is much more leniency in the Lasheves than in the pre-Lasheves. Because in the pre-Lasheves standard, you're dealing with the biblical commandment of Pru Urvu. And therefore we're much more stricter. So you'll find any Pasuk, any Shiloh that you ask about birth control. I'm not saying there are no heterim even before you have any kids. But you will find a big dividing line that, in other words, if all things are okay, don't have birth control even after 10 kids. But if there is a need, the case will be much more lenient after a son and a daughter than it will be before. Let me also point out that although I'm not going to give you a whole shiur on birth control right now, let me just point out that there are some poskim. One interesting question is the idea of spacing between children. Let's say a woman has a child. It's a boy. Now, they have not yet fulfilled Pru Urvu because they don't have a daughter yet. But they want to space between children so that this boy will get, or girl, will get undivided attention for a while. Does halacha recognize spacing and how long as a basis of contraception? So this is a big, big machlokas among poskim. The great Rav Moshe Feinstein was very much against it. He says, unless the mother has psychological or physical illnesses, you know, you just go ahead and have a child as soon as you can.
So for example, postnatal depression wards.
Yes, that's correct. That could be very significant. That could be, even like Rabbi Feinstein, it could be very significant. Depression is certainly an illness, and it can be life-threatening, and it can be infant-threatening as well.
What's the, like, what if you're not really spacing? bracing for the fact, like, some women get no time in between. Like, they might have the baby, and 9 months later, they have to.
Yeah.
Just, like, the amount of time they have to need, they can get pregnant again.
It is the, well, it does happen. Well, you know. No, of course, you know, of course it is very stressful. I don't mean to minimize the stress at all. It is very stressful. The only question is, and again, it's stressful for both parents, but again, the mother almost certainly bears usually a much greater share of the stress, not only in the pregnancy, but also the raising of the child and the multiple children and the like. So certainly, I don't mean to disparage that at all, but Rav Feinstein took a very strong position because he felt very strongly, based on Kabbalah as well, that there is a Gemara that says the Mashiach cannot come till all of the neshamos in Shemayim are born into the world. And he felt that things like contraception could actually delay the revelation of Mashiach, and you never know. First of all, you never really know. What soul have you prevented? Maybe you prevented Mashiach from coming, or the great Gadol Hador, the tzaddik of the generation.
That in itself would drive someone mad.
Well, yeah, but Justice Antonin Scalia. Yeah, I was going to say Justice Antonin Scalia, who's a Roman Catholic, but he's very friendly with the Jewish people. He has a large family. As Catholic, he also doesn't believe in birth control, and he said, having kids is like making pancakes. You know, the first few may not turn out so right, but eventually, you get them.
Yeah, there's one thing.
Unfortunately, you're stuck with them, though. Pancakes,
you just eat them.
Why is it so much fun?
What's so much fun?
Why are you saying bringing a soul? Why are you saying bringing a soul into Ghana?
Slightly less fun than pushing a child through.
Because this world is like a heaven? Well, one second, I understand that, but remember, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's desire, Dira B'Tachtayim, right? He wants to have his dwelling place in this lowly world. And that is how the soul gets closest to Hashem, by bringing the Shekhinah into this world. That's a world of struggle, you're right, it's a veil of tears. It's a world of many, many failures and many, much, much suffering. But the ultimate purpose of creation is that God's dwelling place should be in this world. So it is a very, very important thing. But let me point out that other rabbis have differed with Rabbi Feinstein, and they have brought a very interesting proof. You know that breast nursing, is if you do it 100%, without
100%.
Meaning you don't ever give a bottle. Meaning the baby gets 100% of his nutrition only from nursing, not from occasional bottle feeding. It does work. The truth is, it doesn't work.
Rely on it.
It doesn't work because nobody does it 100%. You switch a bottle, you don't feel like nursing. The Gemara itself says it works. And
how are you supposed to breastfeed apart from according to Halacha?
Why?
No, how long are you
supposed to? Oh, that's right. So the Halacha says the optimal period of breastfeeding is 2 years, 24 months.
No.
Absolutely. Halacha says the optimal period of breastfeeding is... Now, so here's
two
the...
2 years?
Yep, yep. Now, here is the... No. So here is the argument. Here is the interesting analogy. If Halacha encourages breastfeeding for up to 24 months, and if the rabbis taught, even if modern science might disagree, that breastfeeding is essentially contraception for 24 months, then in a sense, what are they saying? That for the benefit of your child, you can defer another pregnancy for up to 24 months. Ergo, they make this argument. So even if you're not breastfeeding, you can delay a pregnancy for 24 months because it is the same underlying logic that would permit breastfeeding. It's very. This is Rav Henkin. In fact, Rav Henkin, you know, Rav Henkin is the rabbi whose son was just killed last week.
But then God would. Yeah.
Well, one at a time. You'll take it.
You can fall pregnant when you're breastfeeding.
Huh?
You can fall pregnant when you're breastfeeding.
Well, okay, but whether the nature changes or not, all I can tell you is the Gemara assumes you can't. So all I'm saying is, based on the Gemara's assumption,
because people made a mistake.
Yeah, so I'm saying.
No, I understand, but that. that doesn't undermine the point, because if Chazal believed, whether it's right or wrong is not even important, if Chazal believed that breastfeeding was equivalent to contraception, and they did believe that, then they are in effect saying you can have contraception for 24 months after the birth of a child in order to enhance the welfare of the child. That is what that teaches me. So the argument Rav Henkin made was that could apply even to a non-nursing mother, that type of spacing would be permitted. Yeah.
So if that spacing was permitted, but then you're not breastfeeding, isn't that unnecessary, like, and you're healthy,
yes,
isn't that halakhically unnecessarily delaying falling pregnant again?
Okay, so the argument is, I understand, but the argument is that the justification for nursing, even though the sages thought it was contraception, is because it is for the benefit of a child to be nursed for 24 months. Now, once you say that, you could...
What if you nurse a child for, let's say, 10 months?
Or, yeah. No, I understand. But then the spacing might be justified for other benefits to the child, of having the mother's undivided attention. Meaning, once you're defining benefit of child as a basis of contraception, that could be broadened to other types of benefit besides nursing. Nursing is one particular benefit, albeit very important, but there might be other benefits.
What about the benefits for you? I mean, not you. A woman, right?
So that's the
you
that's
give
a little
a break,
okay.
So,
Again, it all depends. If it's simply being tired and the like, you know, we're a little less open to that.
What?
No.
The woman is just giving birth.
Okay.
This is.
Okay.
He said it's okay.
Yeah.
24 months.
Yeah. Okay.
Because even according to doctors.
Yeah.
Number one, okay, that's one.
No. If there are, okay. Again, this is very fact. This is very fact sensitive. But if a woman's health requires that there be delays, then halacha permits those delays. Now, certainly, let me repeat. Certainly, after the son and the daughter, for sure, that's going to be the case. But even in the after the first child, that'll be the case. Yeah.
So if you
I will get you. I apologize. Yeah.
So if you want to delay the pregnancy for the benefit of your child or health or whatever, can you be on contraception during that time, or
yes,
basically whatever happens.
No. If one should talk to a rabbi or a posek about the factors that are involved. But yes, there can be. Okay. In fact, I'll even mention more than this. Sometimes in the early stages of a marriage, they're not even sure they want to stay married. I mean, there's conflict, things haven't worked out well, they don't get along. If there is a risk of divorce, we actually don't want them to bring a child into the world then, because that's going to complicate the life of the child a lot. So sometimes contraception will be advised when there's a lack of marital harmony between them. Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah, in the back.
So if you're saying that breastfeeding is like contraception for like the first two.
That's what the sages said, yeah.
Is there something that says that you shouldn't breastfeed longer than 2 years? I'm saying, I know normally it doesn't really work that it's going to prevent it after the child is 2. Number one, like, they're not normally nursing enough that it's going to be that way. But say that they were nursing enough at 2.
Yeah.
Is there a problem with nursing them longer?
There actually is not. Now there is a law, a halacha, that an adult is not allowed to drink breast milk. that much is true. But a child even above 2 is still allowed. There are people who do it. Yeah, in a cup, in a glass, whatever. By the way, breast milk actually is parif. That is true. It's like almond milk. Exactly right.
Also, the milk that you kill an animal, the milk that's killing the daughter.
That's correct. That is correct. But
when you kill an animal, if it's killing the daughter, sure.
Yeah.
Is that true? That it's not kosher.
Breast milk?
Yeah.
No, breast milk is kosher. It is kosher, but the rabbis said an adult should not drink it. But it's not considered treif. It's not a Torah. It's not a Torah law.
Could you like taste it like that?
No,
you shouldn't. You shouldn't. You shouldn't taste it. I mean, you can taste it if you need. If you need to know, is it safe for my child? A mother can taste it.
Safe for my child?
If you freeze it. No, if you freeze it.
Oh. Yeah, whatever. So you know, if it got contaminated, or whatever. Okay. Alrighty. So there is this mitzvah to have children, obviously, and you know, somebody. I once read a story about a person with a large family. Who was going through an airport and a flight to Israel, and it stopped in Germany for some reason, and there was a strict German woman who walked by, and she did not approve of all of these kids, so she said, when are you going to stop, or something like that. So he looked at her and said, when I reach 6 million, I'll consider it.
You know? Oh my God.
Okay. All right. So anyway. All right.
That is quite.
Well, okay.
I would love to see the face of the
wife. No, because the truth of the matter is, you know, we could talk about overpopulation and we could talk about all sorts of issues, but the Jews do not have to take the burden of worrying about overpopulation. We are not the people who contribute to this problem. We are underpopulated, except among the very religious. The Jewish population growth is not very high. There were more Jews in the world before World War II. We still have not. We have not reached pre-World War II numbers. We have not recovered to this day from the Holocaust. In addition to the fact that Jews of the more liberal bent disproportionately have abortions as well. So you think about the number of Jewish women have in other words, of middle class abortions. More are done by Jewish women than non-Jewish women. You have lower class and the like, but middle class abortions are primarily middle and upper class abortions are primarily Jewish people. How did that happen is hard to understand, but that is a statistical fact. In fact, I don't know if you notice advertisements, but you know there's an organization in Israel called Efrat, not to be confused with the city of Efrat, same name, but. And Efrat is an organization that is designed to help women, let's say single mothers to get pregnant, who want to abort. At least, you know, they'll offer either financial assistance or even offer to place the child for adoption and find alternative families in order to encourage the woman not to abort, and just be aware.
Why are you not just going to abortion clinics? Yeah.
Yep. Oh, it's very easy to get an abortion. Israel is a very liberal abortion law, in some ways more liberal than the United States. On the other hand, they do allow, in the United States, anti-abortion organizations are very limited. They're not allowed to be near an abortion clinic. Here, Israel, everything is free, you know, free for all. So they have the abortion clinic, and you can demonstrate in front of the abortion clinic. So they allow everything to kind of go on at once. But it's a real chaval. If you think about it, people have estimated that the number of extra Jews that would be in the world had there not been abortions over the past 50 years would be several million. There would be several million more Jews. You know, it's hard to know, but this is the numbers that they state. Okay, now let me just mention as an aside issue. Let me talk about adoption for a moment, because let's say a couple cannot have children. They cannot have natural children. So they may want to adopt a child, right? They may want to adopt
IVF,
a child.
Though?
I'll talk about that. I'll get to IVF and artificial insemination and surrogacy. But let's first talk about the lowest tech option, and that is you simply want to adopt. Now, the Hebrew word for adoption, which is a modern Hebrew word, it's not a biblical term, is imutz yeladim, imutz. Imutz means to adopt a child. So here is the thing. According to most poskim, although giving an orphaned child a good home, or giving a child a good home, is certainly an act of loving kindness and a very, very great mitzvah, it is technically not a fulfillment of being fruitful and multiply, because being fruitful and multiply requires a biological bond.
But if someone is unable to medically have a child, then aren't they exempt from that?
Yes, that's exactly correct. Meaning, so the way we would describe it is, they have not fulfilled the mitzvah, but they are exempt from the mitzvah. There's a difference, meaning they don't get that mitzvah, but they have not committed any sin because it is the circumstances beyond their control.
What exempts someone from that mitzvah? Is it only incapability?
Well, basically that would be it. If you're incapable.
Someone has a mental problem, they still have that obligation.
Well, it depends how severe the problem is. If the mental impairment is so severe that they really don't understand what they're doing, then they're exempt from all commandments. They don't have to keep Shabbos or kosher or anything else either.
But like not that far. Like the kid's just not going to grow up
in a stable home.
How's that fair?
Well, I understand. But part of the possibility is you bring a child into the world and then place them for adoption, that they would have a home. By the way, this is a problem that Hasidic communities are trying to deal with, and a bit controversial. Let's say you have Down syndrome children, or you know, people who are mentally impaired or retarded. They don't like to use the word anymore, but you know, they have severe mental impairments. So what they do in some Hasidic communities is they actually marry them off with other people who are similarly impaired, and these two impaired parents have children. And they either try to raise the children, or their parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, come in. And some of these have been successful. Some of them have been good, and some of them have been bad. It's a very difficult situation. In New York, this is mainly in Monroe. You know, Monroe, New York, that's a Satmar community. I'm not aware of this being done in Crown Heights, per se, but in Monroe, it is done. And the state has investigated. There have been some cases where the state of New York has moved in and taken the kids away from the parents. There have been other cases where the parents have been able to show that, hey, we're not geniuses, we're not Einsteins, but we're able to raise a child. Like, this is a whole general area. You know, mentally retarded people, I'm sorry if retarded offends anybody, I'm just using an older, I grew up in the ancient world, we used to use those words. But mentally retarded people are not necessarily totally incompetent. They are capable of a certain amount of functioning, and you know, they might
still
be
have high levels of EQ though.
Yeah. But they might be capable of raising children with proper supervision. It's a very delicate balance. But under the guidance of their rebbes, the rebbe actually felt, going back to your question, that even people who are mentally impaired should have children, provided you create the mechanism, and this is very important, where the children can be safely raised and they could be educated properly. And of course, it's a little odd because sometimes two impaired parents could have a child who is perfectly normal. And what eventually happens is when the child reaches 10 or 11, the child is almost the one that is kind of taking care of the parents in some ways. But okay. But these children love their parents and they're grateful to their parents. I mean, when it works out well. And there is a family that exists.
It's too much of a risk. Don't you think it's unfair to place such risk on potential children?
It is an excellent question, and you don't go into this. Yeah, you don't. So you're raising an interesting philosophical question, and that is like this: is it better for a child to come into the world impaired if the alternative is not to come into the world? See, that's the question.
Yeah.
You're saying it's unfair because there's such a risk the child will be impaired. Well, I'll say, well, it would be unfair not to do it, because that way that soul doesn't come into the world at all. Right? So it might be better to have the child in the world.
Is the soul bound to a body? What about the soul would just come in a different body that wouldn't be impaired?
Well,
like, how do we know where the soul...
Our assumption is that every soul is destined for a specific location. I mean, that's the assumption. Meaning it's not like God just chooses souls. You know, this soul is this body, right? And if you're not going to do it, then this soul is not going to come down.
So the soul is an ultimatum. You're coming to this body.
That's correct. And, you know, have you ever heard the famous teaching? Again, some people don't like it, but it is a teaching that a great rabbi said. The story goes that he used to stand up when there were severely retarded kids or adults walking in, because he said their neshamos are on a higher level because they don't need the perfection of doing the commandments or studying Torah. they came into the world at an exalted level that doesn't need the ticket. So who knows? Who knows? There's a lot that we don't understand about this. But all I can say practically is that if you are a Rebbe that is encouraging those types of unions, you have to be absolutely sure there's a protective structure that will ensure the children's safety and life. Even something as routine as cooking. If somebody is very impaired, they could just start a fire in the house when they try to boil water. So one has to be very, very, very careful. But it is an experiment that they've been trying. And the truth of the matter is, within the mental health community, outside of Judaism, mm-hmm. there are people who are advocating for the rights of the mentally impaired to have families, assuming that they're capable of some minimal parenting in a loving way. Listen, unfortunately, there are many non-mentally impaired adults who are totally improper, not worthy of being parents, whatever. Okay, all right. Now, let me just mention a few things about adoption that might surprise you a little bit. And that is, adoption does not confer Jewish status automatically. Now, here's an interesting question. Is it better to adopt? Okay, I want to adopt a child. Is it better for me to adopt a Jewish child? Or is it better for me to adopt a non-Jewish child? Oh, so here it depends. If the question is, what's a bigger mitzvah? 100% certain it is a much bigger mitzvah to give a Jewish child a home than a non-Jewish child. It's a mitzvah to give any child a home, but a Jewish child, we have a special obligation. However, if you're asking which has more halachic complications, it is much more complicated to adopt a Jewish child than to adopt a non-Jewish child. And the reason is that when you adopt a Jewish child, you have to be concerned for the origin of that child's birth. Remember, we discussed in our last session, we discussed the idea of mamzer. If a child is born from adultery, a Jewish child, that child may have the stigma of mamzer. He could not marry other Jews. Now, when you adopt a Jewish child, unless you know the family history, perhaps this is a child out of adultery or out of incest. And if that's so, it's a mamzer, and the child would have to be told that he couldn't marry certain people. See, if you adopt a non-Jewish child, you don't care about that. Because when you adopt a non-Jewish child, the non-Jewish child undergoes a conversion to Judaism, and conversion erases the slate. So, on one hand, it is a much bigger mitzvah to adopt a Jewish child. On the other hand, as a practical matter, to avoid the complications of mamzer, most rabbis will advise a couple to adopt a non-Jewish child. Now, let me point out, adoption does not make a non-Jew Jewish. Just because I adopt a child, if the child was born from a non-Jew, they're still a non-Jew. Adoption does not make the child Jewish. The child must be converted. How do you convert a baby? I adopt a child from birth, or I adopt a child who's 1 year old or 2 year old. How do I convert him? Well, conversion normally has three steps for a man and two steps for a woman. What are the three steps? If a man wants to convert, what are the three things a man must do? Circumcision, immersion in the mikveh, and in front of a beis din of three rabbis, he must accept upon himself the Torah. A woman has two out of the three. A woman immerses, and a woman accepts the commandments. Now, these are when an adult converts. A baby obviously cannot accept, the commandments. So how does this work? So if I'm adopting a male baby, so what I do is, I dunk the baby, the baby has a bris, right, a circumcision. I wait till the bris heals. And then the baby goes to the mikveh. How does a baby go to the mikveh? I take the baby and I throw him into the mikveh? No, that's not going to work. So what happens is, Abba, Daddy, goes into the mikveh with his bathing suit or shirt, however he wants to be, he can go with his suit if he wants, and he holds the baby slumped over his arms like a football or whatever it is. He lowers his arms for a second, and the baby is immersed that way. So it's very, very safe. Same thing for a girl.
You're allowed to convert a child before they're aware?
Yes, yes. I'll discuss why that's so. A child to be can be converted from the moment they are born. Now, parents sometimes say they're afraid to dunk a newborn baby in the mikveh. They're afraid the baby will drown. They're afraid the baby will inhale water. But it's actually very, very safe, and it's actually very, very cute. What's important is the baby has to hit the water face down. And that activates a swimming reflex. Remember, the baby was in the you know, in the womb a while ago, surrounded by water, and the baby starts doing the dog paddle. You know, it's very, very cute. When you take the baby out, the baby will cry, but he will not cry because of water. He will cry because of the change of temperature. The mikveh water is warmer than the room temperature. And when the baby is taken out suddenly from the water, the baby is cold. But it's very, very safe. And interestingly enough, the younger the baby is, the safer it is. Meaning to say, after 6 months, it's still safe, but after 6 months, the baby's losing the reflex. He may not hold his breath. He may swallow a little water. So it's actually better to immerse the baby earlier than 6 months than afterwards. But here's my question. I understand we've done two out of the three. We've done given the baby a bris, and we've immersed him. Or if it's a girl, we've immersed her. But what about accepting the commandments? The baby hasn't accepted the commandments.
No, but then you have the commandment of educating the baby.
Right, so the answer is, the parents who adopt the baby are obligated to affirm in front of the Beit Din that they will raise the child in accordance with the mitzvot and the halacha, and they become the surrogates who accept the commandments on behalf of the child, even though the child is earlier than the age of even conscious awareness of what is going on. But this has a very important consequence. Normally, when an adult converts to Judaism, they cannot change their mind. Judaism is a one-way street. We let you in, we don't let you out. We got you. But when a minor is converted to Judaism, since it was not their own decision, they do have the right to renounce their conversion when they reach bas mitzvah, in the case of a girl, which is 12, or bar mitzvah, which is 13. But people make a mistake here. They don't have to reaccept. It's the other way around. They have the right to renounce. But if they don't renounce on their 12th or 13th birthday, they have one day. If they don't do it by that day, they are stuck. So if the day after my bar mitzvah, I'm an adopted child, I say, I really wish I didn't have to do this, too late. You have to make that decision.
You have to tell them that they were converted?
Yes, and because of that, Rabbi Feinstein says, you must tell them, because if you don't tell them, when they find out at age 45, they can revoke it then. Because silence cannot be acquiescence unless you knew you had the option. It's important to understand this. This is the only case where you can renounce a conversion. An adult who converts cannot renounce a conversion. But when a child below bar mitzvah is converted, they can renounce. But again, for some reason, a lot of people have the impression that the child has to go to the mikveh again. Not true. The conversion will be finalized unless there is renunciation. If there's no renunciation, the person's Jewish based on the earlier conversion. Yeah.
What if a couple, you know, appropriately does the bris and does the mikvah and then doesn't end up raising the child?
Yeah. So we run into difficulties, but it would appear the following. In a sense, as long as they made the commitment and the Beis Din believed the commitment was sincere, then we will treat the subsequent reneging similar to an adult convert who stops keeping the commandments, in which case they are still Jewish. You see? In other words, on the other hand, if the commitment was not sincere to begin with, if it was a fraud, if it was a lie, that would be a serious issue. In fact, that's an issue in Israel now with adult conversions, where people say they accept the Torah and they really don't. And we are invalidating some of those conversions. So that would be the similar idea. Now, it's a little, again, this is a difficult area because some rabbis are more lenient here. Some rabbis basically say that as long as you agree to send your child to a Jewish religious school, even if you're not religious at all, we'll allow the conversion. Others say the family actually has to be observant. So there are going to be different rules here, which is very confusing, very, very problematical, because that means that some rabbis will say the child is Jewish, and some rabbis will say the child is not Jewish. That's very, very disconcerting. And when people come to Israel, they often discover, people who have converted come to Israel, and they often discover that their, or I don't mean conservative conversions, I'm talking about their Orthodox conversions are not going to be recognized. And that's, as I say, that's a difficult problem, but part of the issue is because different rabbis are following different halachic views here, and that creates a lot of confusion. Now, I know, I came from the Washington area, and for many years, I was involved with a day school. Let me tell you a situation that we often face. Let's imagine, Baruch Hashem, we don't face it in Israel that much. Let's imagine we have an intermarried couple. Man, Jewish man, marries a non-Jewish woman. Not a convert, a non-Jewish woman. The children they have are therefore, as you know, non-Jewish. Because if mom is not Jewish, kids are not Jewish. But in the course of their marriage, they begin gravitating towards more traditional life. And the woman perhaps, may consider converting in the future. They're not quite religious yet, but they're gravitating. Maybe they go to a Chabad house, etc. Might be a common scenario. Now, here is the problem. 2 or 3 years down the road, maybe they'll all be religious. But now they have a child who's about to enter first grade. The child right now is a non-Jew. We can't convert the child right now because the parents are not fully decided if they're going to live a religious lifestyle. On the other hand, maybe they will be religious 3 or 4 years down the road, but then the kid will be at such a disadvantage because he's missing 3 or 4 years of a Jewish education. Do you understand the problem? So, I'm the principal of a school. Do I accept? I can't say, let's convert the child now, because maybe there's not a commitment to raise him religiously yet. But if I turn him down, I'm putting him at a great disadvantage if the mother does become Jewish later. So what a lot of schools do is, a lot of schools will accept a non-Jewish student to the school with the understanding that there must be a conversion on the part of the parents and the child within 2 or 3 years. Otherwise the child will have to leave. Meaning there's that kind of expectation that we're accepting you provisionally on the condition that you make progress in your Judaism. If you don't, then you don't belong here. So there was one case where a girl, Baruch Hashem, it has a happy ending, but the school was going crazy over this, where somehow a girl was accepted in kindergarten. This was a co-ed school. It was much more of a modern school. And her mother was non-Jewish, and she was non-Jewish. And somehow people just forgot about it for 12 years. 12 years! So she's about to graduate high school, and she's still a non-Jewish girl. But to say that God has a sense of humor, as the saying goes, it happened to be she was also the Hebrew valedictorian of the school. So the school, I was not aware of any of this, but the school calls me up like the night before graduation. Our Hebrew valedictorian is a non-Jewish girl who never converted. Somehow we just weren't keeping track. And it really doesn't look good to have a non-Jewish girl be the Hebrew valedictorian, and she's going to get a diploma from the school, and people will look at that as proof that she's Jewish, perhaps, and she'll go out with a Jewish guy, and what do we do? Do we have to put on every diploma, like a cigarette warning? Holder of this diploma is not proof that you're Jewish. What do we do? What do you do at that point? I mean, you can't take it away from her. So I just gave him a stern lecture about, you can't let this happen again type of thing, But the bottom line was that Baruch Hashem, she came to Israel for a year after high school graduation, and she got much more committed to a Torah lifestyle, and she converted halachically, and she got married, and has a nice Jewish family, so everything worked out well. But for 12 years, she was passed along as a halachic non-Jew, who became the valedictorian of the school. So it is an issue. Now let me point out, though, a very interesting point that you need to understand. And that is, since a girl or a boy becomes an adult at 12 or 13, once they become 12 or 13, we don't care about the parents anymore. We just focus on the kids. So let's say mom and dad are not religious. So I can't convert their child because mom and dad cannot make the commitment they're going to raise the child religiously. But once the child reaches 12 or 13, they can now make their own decision. And if they have the strength and the maturity to want to live a religious life, even if their parents are not religious, and there are people who do that, then we can convert the 12 or 13 year old, even if the parents are not religious. We couldn't convert the minor child on that basis, but we could convert the 12 or 13 year old. So at some point, what sometimes happens is, if mom is still not there yet, when the child becomes 12, or the girl becomes 12, or the boy 13, we can convert them in their own right, if they're willing, only if they're willing to make the commitment to be an Orthodox Jew, living in a non-Orthodox home. And again, there are many young teenagers that do that. They're strong enough to be able to keep the commandments, and hopefully their parents will support them in that decision, even if the parents themselves are not Shomer Shabbos. Yeah.
Does an adopted child and a parent relationship have the same standing halachically as the relationship between a biological child and a parent?
Okay, so here let me mention some things that I guess as potential Lubavitchers, or at least students in a Chabad institution, you do need to know. And that is, although obviously the love and affection does exist with adopted parents, it is not the same biologically in a lot of ways. Let me give you a few examples. If the father is a Kohen, the adopted child is not a Kohen. He does not become a Kohen by virtue of the father, etc. That's one thing. Technically speaking, when father or mother die, technically speaking, the child is under no obligation to sit Shiva or say Kaddish, although he is encouraged to do so as a matter of gratitude. Now, what is a bit more problematical is an actual decision of the Rebbe. You know, the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, did not generally like to paskin on day-to-day halachic questions. He left it to rabbis to rule on these things. But one of the few areas that he actually issued a halachic ruling was the issue of yichud and negiyah. You know what that phrase is? Yichud is the prohibition of a man and a woman being in seclusion. Right? I'm not allowed to be alone in a room with a woman except for my wife, my daughter, my mother. Right? My sister, perhaps. So the question becomes this. If I have my own biological daughter, I could be alone with her. If my wife has a biological son, she can be alone with him. But what if we have an adopted child that we are not biologically related to? Now, when they're babies, that's not a problem, but let's say at the point that they become older, is there an issur of yichud? Is there an issur of hugging and kissing? So the Rebbe was actually very, very strict. The Rebbe basically ruled that since adoption is not the same as a biological bond, so the Rebbe said there is an issur of yichud and negiyah between adopted children and the adoptive parents. Now, again, that doesn't kick in as a baby, but let's take a practical example. What would that mean? If we adopt a girl, okay? So when do I have to stop, according to the Rebbe, when would I have to stop hugging and kissing the girl? I can certainly kiss her as a baby because I can kiss any baby, right? But basically, when she reaches, let's say, the age of menstruation, whatever it might be, 11 years old, I would not be allowed to hug or kiss her, according to the Rebbe. Now, this is the Rebbe's view, and indeed many, many rabbis have said the same thing. I will tell you there is another view from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. And Rabbi Waldenberg said the following idea. He said that this concept that a mother-son has no issur of yichud or hugging, or a father-daughter is not based on biology, but it's based on the reality that when you raise somebody as an infant, you generally do not have unhealthy sexual desires. And therefore, the Tzitz Eliezer of Oldenburg ruled that as long as you adopted the child from infancy, that means less than 1 year old, you treat them as a biological child, and there is no iser of yichud or negia. So, I'm not telling you what to follow. Generally speaking, in my years as a rabbi, I generally followed the more lenient view because I thought it was very, very important that adoptive children have a sense of physical affection and the like, especially if there's also natural children. I mean, it's kind of crazy. I am aware of homes, and this is horrendous, in which there are adopted children and there are biological children, and mom will hug the natural children and will not hug the adopted children. And that just sounds a little horrendous to me. So I would follow Rev Oldenburg. But I do want to point out that even Rev Oldenburg is not a panacea here, because Rev Oldenburg did stipulate that the adoption must have occurred within the first year of birth. Now, sometimes people adopt older kids, and usually if you adopt older kids, they have more serious emotional problems. That's why they were not adopted at a younger age. According to Rev Oldenburg, if you adopted a five-year-old, you would have an iser of yichud. Now, not right away, but at the point at which the child becomes 11 or whatever it is. So there are going to be situations where the halacha is going to be very difficult to carry out. Yeah.
What if hypothetically the adoptive daughter starts her menstruation around 15, 16? They're old ones. So what do you do then? Do you wait for that event to stop?
Well, it's a little difficult because it's not menstruation per se that triggers it. It's really the physical development of breasts and things like that. So the question is, if the delay in menstruation would be a delay in puberty in that sense, which it might be, then that might be a justification. But it's more in the nature of the physical development. Yeah.
What about parents? When
the
kid is like 1 or 2 years old.
Yeah. Actually, your point is a very excellent point, because that might even be a more common problem. We treat step parents, even if they haven't legally adopted, as adoptive parents, and indeed, there will be a prohibition of yichud and negia towards step children. Meaning 100% correct. A step parent. Now again, when they're little, there's no problem. But when they're older, there would be a problem of hugging, kissing, and yichud with them. Yes, 100% correct. Step parents are the same problem as adoptive parents. Yeah.
I've heard of a family who have an adopted girl, and she can be alone. She can be in yichud with her father, but she doesn't touch her.
Hmm.
I think the opposite.
I'm just curious about that, because
and their sons are chassidim.
Okay, in other words, they're splitting the two things. Yeah, and that's a little peculiar, because normally yichud and touching go lockstep together. Right?
It's hard enough to be in yichud with your father and your...
Well, yeah, I understand it's hard, but well, you know, I mean, let me put it this way, it's not as hard as it sounds. I mean, I'll give you an example. If the husband is in, a wife can be in yichud with a man if her husband is in town, is not out of town, even if he's not at home, right? So there'll be a lot of cases where you might be alone with somebody, but you know, either the door is open or people can come in or the husband is in town, right? So there are a lot of scenarios where technically you're alone, but lamaisa it's permitted. I mean, yichud is a vast area. I mean, maybe we'll give a shiurim on it. I mean, a doctor and a patient, right? I mean, everything, you know, a psychiatrist and a client. Everything is yichud, but we say that if people can walk in on you, you know, it's not considered to be forbidden. Yeah.
The step parents, is it the same if they're not Jewish? It's also yichud.
Technically, if they're not Jewish, there would not be the same prohibition. That is correct, because yichud is a prohibition of a Jew and a Jew primarily. Yeah. Okay. So those are things you need to know a little bit about adoption. Adoption, as I say, is a low tech solution to not having kids. But once again, certainly it is a great mitzvah. Chazal say, anyone that gives an orphan a home is spiritually as if they gave birth to him. So even though it's not the same as a biological child, it is a great, great mitzvah just the same. But now, yeah, well, I'll begin talking. Let's talk a little bit about the higher tech solutions to having a kid. And let's first start with a technique that has been around for a very long time, really 150 years, so it's not even that recent anymore. I remember it from my childhood. And that is artificial insemination. Artificial insemination, let's say, for example, you have a situation where a man cannot impregnate a woman in the normal way through intercourse, whatever it is. So we have a procedure called artificial insemination. Now, artificial insemination can take two different forms. There is artificial insemination from a sperm donor, and that's often abbreviated AID, artificial insemination from donor sperm. And usually that'll be from an anonymous sperm bank, but in theory, you can even have a known person. And then there is what is called AIH, artificial insemination with the husband's own semen. Now you may ask, well, if the husband's own semen could make his wife pregnant, then why do they need it? Why don't they just do it regular? Well, the answer is that sometimes an individual ejaculate may have a low motility or whatever it is, but if you combine many, many ejaculates and then inject it, it could create a pregnancy when a single ejaculate couldn't. So the truth is that AIH is to this very day a technique that is used, and now they couple it with various splitting the egg. In other words, they can inject a single spermatozoa into an egg, as it were, with a needle, etc. So it comes in and penetrates. If the sperm is not strong enough or the egg is too tough, they can actually inject it into that egg. Miraculous things. But that's really artificial insemination. Now, I'm not yet talking about IVF, although most commonly this is done with IVF, but I'm talking about there could actually be intrauterine. There could be an injection directly into the uterus. So let's first talk about AID. AID is a very, very fascinating halachic debate. Donor sperm. There was a great Hasidic Rebbe, the Satmar Rebbe. You may have heard of the Satmar Rebbe. Satmar and Chabad have had a long-standing feud on gazillions of issues. But the Satmar Hasidim were best known, and probably are best known, for their extreme anti-Zionist stance. they believe that there shouldn't be a state of Israel, etc., until the Mashiach comes, and the like. Well, that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. That's another topic. But the Satmar Rebbe, who was a big Talmud Chacham, he was a very great man, took a pretty extreme position. The Satmar Rebbe said the following. The Satmar Rebbe said that if a married Jewish woman is impregnated by the sperm of a man other than her husband, she has halakhically committed adultery because of the injection of that sperm. And that has a number of interesting consequences. Consequence number one, because she has committed adultery, she is not permitted to stay married to her husband. Her husband must divorce her. He cannot forgive adultery. Rape he could forgive, but rape wouldn't be a problem for that. But voluntary adultery, a woman must leave her husband. And number two, the child is a mamzer. So the Satmar Rebbe says, AID, can't do it. It's adultery and it creates mamzer. The great Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote four responsa in which he took issue with the Satmar Rebbe, and he said, number one, it is not adultery because injection of sperm is not the same as intercourse. It is not intercourse, it is injection of sperm with a syringe. And therefore, Rabbi Feinstein said, the child is not a mamzer because a mamzer is generated only from adultery or incest, and this is not adultery. Therefore, the child is not a mamzer. Well, but Rav Feinstein said, so therefore, that's good news. The good news is AID does not produce this complication. But Rabbi Feinstein said, there's another reason why AID should not be pursued. And he said, AID creates a potentiality of secret, unknown incest. You see why? Because anonymous sperm donors tend to make a lot of contributions because they get paid. They get paid for it. And unlike egg donors who have to undergo surgery, sperm donors can get money for very little work. So what happens is this. If the woman gets impregnated with donor sperm and has a girl, that girl may grow up to marry a boy who was impregnated by the same donor, whose mother was impregnated by the same donor sperm.
Isn't the chance of that
so? Okay, now, I know, people say, the first reaction is, guys, that's never going to happen in a million years. We actually have cases of that happening.
No, absolutely.
And in fact, there's no joke. I'll try to bring in actual numbers. We actually have situations of sperm donor siblings who were on the verge of getting married. Now they have DNA testing. Now they can do it ahead of time. And this actually happens. You know what they say? They say...
Huh?
Now they can do testing. I understand. But not everybody tests. Now, therefore, bottom line is that both Rabbi Feinstein and the Satmar Rebbe discouraged AID, but for two different reasons. Satmar Rebbe was so strict, he treated AID as adultery and mamzer. Rabbi Feinstein said it's not adultery and it's not mamzer, but we should discourage it because of potential incest. But then Rabbi Feinstein said something else that is really a bit of a kicker. He said, you know, if a woman really needs to have a child in this way, she should be sure that the sperm donor is a goy rather than a Jew. Because if the sperm donor is a goy, halachic incest is not going to apply. And the reason is because a non-Jewish father is not halachically related. If they impregnate a Jewish woman, in other words, assuming the boy is going to marry a Jewish girl, so even if it's the same sperm donor, if he was non-Jewish, the brother and sister, now, genetically they're related, so you have that problem, but halachically they're not related. So Rabbi Feinstein said that, you know, okay, AID is going to be okay if you get a non-Jewish donor, which in the United States you assume that's the case. Now, this enraged the Satmar community, because not only is Rabbi Feinstein disagreeing with their rabbi, but he's now saying Jewish women should get impregnated by non-Jewish sperm. That's, you know, that's tuma, and it just sounds like a very, very bad thing to do. And Rabbi Feinstein was burnt in effigy. There was all sorts of riots, all sorts of things going on. And finally, Rabbi Feinstein said, I don't know what this means myself, he says, Although everything he said was right, he withdraws his heter. What does it mean to withdraw a heter if you say everything? I mean, it's one thing if you say, my reasoning was incorrect. It's, everything I wrote is correct, but I withdraw my permission. So, okay, so we really don't know exactly.
Someone had done it, and then it still applies them? If after the heter was removed? Or like, are they now viewed as...
Oh, no. They're not viewed as mamzer. He just said it's not proper to do. That's all. He still said they're not a mamzer. Now, let me just add one final question. That is, a question that people ask today is, okay, married women to have AID is at least an issue of adultery, mamzer, and the like. What about single women? Right, this is unfortunately a live issue. A woman is a single woman. And let's say she's 35, 36, 37, maybe she's 40 already. The fertility options are rapidly diminishing, although not impossible. In fact, what? A woman in Israel had a baby at 61, 63.
Yes,
she went to Russia. She went to Russia to do it. But be it as it may, but let's say she feels that she's either not going to get married or she's not going to find a mate while she's still fertile, so she very much wants to have a child. She doesn't want to just have sex with somebody. That would not be, you know, she's a religious woman. So the question would be, would halacha allow her to go to an anonymous sperm bank, be impregnated, and at least raise a child? Right? So she's not committing adultery. She's not having an affair. She's not violating the laws of Nida in any way. So the question is, what would halacha say about the use of sperm banks by single mothers? So, as you say, this is a bit of a controversial area. We don't have a lot of psak halacha on this. Some rabbis basically say, no, we don't want single women to get pregnant, no matter what. But there was a recent rabbi from the Dati Leumi community, the religious Zionist community, who basically said, he laid down some conditions. I mean, some of them are artificial, like how does he make these lines, but he basically said like this. He said, there are two reasons why we would discourage single mothers from getting pregnant. Reason number one is that the Gemara tells us that there are three partners in the creation of a human being. There is a father, a mother, and then God. And the optimal family is a father and a mother, and that brings Hashem into the equation. And although it is very true, of course, that there are many families in which one parent might die or get divorced, that just happens. But to deliberately create a child when you know ahead of time that there's not going to be a father, some say that's improper because that is violating the kind of family that Hashem says you should have. That is one argument. And the other argument is, we don't want to create incentives for women not to get married, because having a child is one of the reasons women want to get married. If we now say, oh, you can have a child without getting married, then why bother with that bum? Why do I need a man in the house? I can have a kid without the man. So since we want to encourage marriage, we don't want to create incentives to have children. So because of this, Rabbi Sherlo laid down a rule. It's kind of a rule he just made up, but this is his psak. His psak is, if the woman is 40 years old and she has been trying conscientiously to get married for at least 10 years, and she has, now how do you measure that, but she's really been trying, she didn't just decide, I want to be a single mother. She's been trying for 10 years to get married. Under those circumstances, he was willing to give a heter for a woman to utilize a sperm bank, a single mother. Yeah. This is Rav Yuval Sherlo. Again, I don't know how to describe him exactly. He's a respected rabbi. He's not a gadol. We would not call him a gadol like Rav Moshe Feinstein or Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. But he's a respected rabbi in the religious Zionist community, and he was willing to issue such a psak. Many other rabbis are very much against it, but I want to give you at least both sides of the debate so you understand that issue. Okay? So this is kind of artificial insemination with a donor. And the next time we will talk about husband, IVF, surrogacy, egg donation, and maybe even cloning. We'll look at that, which we don't quite do yet, okay? Different ways of having children. Alrighty, you all take care and stay safe.
Do they say no because it would appear to others like you're doing an avera, like you...
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, that's part of it. Part of it also is you see single women pregnant, you know, and nobody knows how they got pregnant, and, you know, it's also a question of the appearances of fooling around with people.
And you wouldn't cover your hair, but you'd be...
Well, that's another thing. That's right. You certainly wouldn't have to cover your hair. That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay.